Many businesses are closed or changing operations because of the coronavirus pandemic, but Illinois' truck drivers are still on the road.
I just went through Chicago at 5:15, and I didn't have to pump the brakes one time.
We'll check in with a trucker and an association that represents truck stops and travel centers. And while the stay-at-home orders have been tough on a lot of us, it's particularly challenging for those in addiction recovery programs, where group meetings are such an important part of the process. Finally, spring is a time for music students to share what they've been working on in recitals. So, how can they stay connected with public performance when the public has to stay home? A live mini concert on this edition of The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. Our program airs on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. First, the news. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Another day, another record increase in the number of Illinois' confirmed cases of COVID-19. As we go to air Thursday morning, more than 15,000 people have been officially diagnosed with coronavirus disease, though the number of actual cases is thought to be much higher. 462 people have died. On the subject of numbers, last week, Governor J.B. Pritzker said it was crucial that Illinois be able to test 10,000 people a day. That's the number public health experts say can help identify hotspots so the state can have a more targeted response. But Wednesday afternoon, Pritzker began his daily briefing like this.
Folks, I promised you honesty and transparency in every step of our COVID-19 response, so here it is. We have only just recently surpassed 6,000 tests, and we will not reach the 10,000 mark this week.
The governor says the goal is dependent on automating some of the testing, but the equipment they bought for that purpose is not yet productive or accurate enough. Coming up later this hour on the 21st, Illinois' stay-at-home order has been tough on a lot of people. But for those in addiction recovery programs, where group meetings are often such an important part of the process, it can be particularly challenging. We'll talk with a couple of experts about how people are coping. If you or someone you know is in recovery and have a question, or if you want to join the conversation later this hour, give us a call, 800-222-9455. First, however, almost no part of the American economy has been untouched by the coronavirus pandemic. That goes especially for an industry that touches almost every part of the American economy, trucking. For one perspective on what's happening on the roads, earlier this week I checked in with Steve Wilmert. He drives a flatbed long distance out of Springfield. He says he hauls a lot of construction material, but the day we spoke, he'd been up in Michigan delivering a load of hay to a dairy farm. By the time I caught up with him, he was back in Illinois, heading south on Interstate 57, just outside Kankakee. I asked him if the COVID-19 shutdowns have affected his work.
From my standpoint, not being in the food industry, you know, and hauling that kind of stuff, I would say it's starting to slow down. I know I was fortunate. I got loaded Thursday with a load to take home. But I know I was talking to my fleet manager this morning. He said Friday was getting a little rough trying to find loads for guys. And then I didn't have trouble this morning finding a load, but one of my buddies that works for the same company, he was down in St. Louis, and he sat for a couple hours waiting for our company to find a load that they could dispatch to him, which is St. Louis on a Monday morning shouldn't be a problem finding a load. So we're starting to see some impacts. You know, some companies have minimized their crews. Some companies have shut down altogether, I guess.
One of the things we've heard is that, especially people going, you know, long distance truck driving, I would imagine that roadside facilities are key. And of course, restaurants are closed, at least in Illinois and in a lot of other states. But we've also heard about truck stops shutting down services like showers and things like that. I wonder, what have you seen in that regard, and is it affecting you?
I stick mainly to like the Midwest states, and I have not seen any of that. I've been very fortunate. I've heard about it in places like Pennsylvania and out east. I really have not run into any issues with either getting a shower at the truck stops or any rest areas that have been closed up. Everything's pretty much been business as usual, except for sometimes the facility might be closed, but they've got, you know, like porta-johns or something set up. Mm. So, I mean, you can still do what you need to do.
And what do the roads look like? Does traffic seem any different than it usually does?
Oh, it's definitely different. I just went through Chicago at 5:15, and I didn't have to pump the brakes one time.
Huh.
So,
wow.
It is definitely different, which I'm glad to see, you know. Especially in Chicago, it's bad enough getting through there as it is, but, you know, I'm happy to see less cars on the road.
Sure.
At least some people are listening.
And, you know, I wonder about that. Do you feel like you have what you need to do your job safely, even as this virus is out there?
Well, I mean, I'm as prepared as I guess as I can be. I've got hand sanitizer. I've got disinfecting wipes in my truck. Most of the places I've been to have been very proactive as far as changing their setup for their receiving office or shipping windows. You know, they've put up plexiglass. They've put up hand sanitizing stations at a lot of the places I've been to, you know, to help out so that they can keep their business going and keep everybody safe. So, I mean, I feel pretty good about it. I'm not a big germaphobe type guy as it is. I don't ever get sick. So me personally, I'm not all that worried about it. Knock on wood, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm worried about it. I would never want to be somebody that was transmitting it, but
right.
You know, I do what they tell us to do. Stay 6 feet away from everybody. Wash my hands or hand sanitize as often as I need to, and just be smart about it. Just use some common sense.
And what about economically? Do you have concerns? I mean, you mentioned a little bit of a slowdown starting to creep into the industry. Do you envision you know, possibly having to stay home at some point?
That's a fear, obviously. I've been glad to keep working. But like I told my fleet manager, I said, yeah, I'm in a different situation than most folks. I got a nice severance package a couple of years ago that I never spent. So if I told him, I said, if it comes down to me going home and some guy with kids that needs to work being on the road, send me home. I said, I would rather be the guy taking the downtime because I can afford to. I said, I would not want to be taking food out of somebody's family or away from somebody's family out driving just to be selfish. So, I mean, for me, I mean, yeah, I don't want to slow down, but, you know, if it comes down to it, you know, so be it. You know, I'm not going to sweat it because I don't live check to check like some folks do. Cause, you know, I don't have kids.
Yeah. The last thing I want to ask you about is we've heard a lot about essential workers lately. And I think if we could go back a month or two and ask people to list out, you know, who do you think is an essential worker? A lot of them are going to say, what, firefighters, police officers, nurses, doctors. But now, of course, we're all awake to the idea that people who work in grocery stores and gas stations are pretty essential. And obviously so are the men and women who drive the trucks that get food and gas and other products to those essential operations. I wonder, have you always felt like an essential worker? Has that changed in the past month or so?
I mean, I realize what truck driving does for the economy as a whole. So, I mean, me personally, I always felt like, you know, if truck drivers decided to shut down, the whole country would be screwed. But, you know, I think other people might be realizing that. But, you know, I've always had the opinion everybody's essential in one form or another. So, I mean, I never looked at it like I was doing something special or anything like that. I'm just playing a role. My job's nothing if the guy at the factory doesn't show up to cut the steel. You know, I mean, everybody plays a part. So, you know, and having worked in retail for 10 years, you know, stocking shelves and stuff, you know, I've always known how important that is, even though people minimize it. Because, you know, well, if it ain't on a shelf, you can't buy it.
Is there anything else that you've seen or that strikes you that I haven't mentioned that's worth talking about that you're seeing out there in the world?
I think I'm just glad to see people being proactive. You know, like I said, I mean, I've never seen so much hand sanitizer my whole life, you know, going to different places and stuff. And even job sites, you know, you see the porta-johns, but it's very rare that you see the hand-washing station and sanitizer station next to the porta-johns. I mean, even the job sites are being more proactive so they can try to make sure they keep their business going.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, I've been overall, I guess I'd just say I've been happy with the response.
Yeah.
You know, of seeing how people have been acting and responding. I mean, there's still some idiots that walk right up next to you when you're standing, you know, 6 feet back from the window or whatever, because somebody's up there, but they get the hint real quick when you 6'5", 265, and you turn around and look at them like, dude, get back.
Well, thank you so much again. I appreciate it, and drive safely and stay well.
All right, man. Thank you.
Steve Wilmert speaking with us earlier this week from his flatbed heading south on Interstate 57. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation here. As Steve mentioned, truck stops are critical for drivers. We're joined now by Lisa Mullings. She's president and CEO of the National Association of Truck Stop Owners. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us, and welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be with you.
So, Lisa, Steve, the truck driver, mentioned there that he's seeing trucks and travel stops remaining open, at least in the Midwest. Is that the case around the country?
Yes. Truck stops and travel plazas are open. I'm not aware of one truck stop that's closed or that has closed. I think a lot of people are getting confused about the difference between a truck stop and a rest area. A rest area is the state-run facilities, and those are not the same as truck stops. So I think there has been some confusion, but I'm not aware of any truck stops that have closed.
Yeah, and here in Illinois, the rest areas don't have gas, usually just a couple of vending machines or something like that. So truckers, I think, are essential workers, but obviously so are the truck stops and travel plazas that serve them. So what are you hearing from members of your organization?
Well, first, I just love what Steve said about everybody's essential in one way or another. And I thought that was really gracious of him, because the truck drivers really are the heroes of the, you know, of this whole emergency, because they are putting themselves at risk going out there and delivering these products. So I appreciate what they're doing and what Steve's doing. But I do think that our members feel a sense of pride that they are supporting these drivers as they, you know, are bringing these emergency medical supplies and food and other things that we need. So they are very much, you know, feeling a lot of pride and patriotism, because they think what they're doing is important. And I agree.
You know, one of our producers shared an article with me where in which you were recently quoted as saying that, you know, what should be 20-minute stops are turning into 2-hour layovers, and that it's imperative that local officials enforce occupancy caps in truck stops. I wonder if you're concerned about anything like that as you know, truckers, as we heard from Steve, are sometimes waiting longer to get dispatched to loads.
Yes. And, you know, one of the issues that we're having is, you know, there are literally thousands of counties all over the country. And a lot of the decisions about restrictions are being made at the county level. And so a place in Texas, for example, you know, they're telling a business that is a 20,000 square foot business that they can only have 10 people, including employees, in the building at one time. And, you know, when you consider that an average convenience store is about 3,000 square feet, you can see why, you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for a big truck stop to just only have 10 people, including employees, especially when there are drivers that are needing to use the showers and they are in the showers, or, you know, they're getting food at the food court, or, you know, there's different areas inside one building at a truck stop. So it's basically, I think, that these health officials that are well-intentioned, they don't understand the difference between a truck stop and some other smaller retail businesses.
Yeah,
and
I guess
so
you can't.
What we're trying to do, yeah, we've been trying to educate them, because we know they're trying to keep their people safe, and that makes a whole lot of sense to me. But we also have to understand that these truckers need to get moving and they need to get back on the road. So we've been making pretty good progress, and we've been touching base with a lot of counties to try to get them to understand. And a lot of them now understand, and they have loosened some of those restrictions.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we've only got about a minute left in our conversation, but I'm wondering what sort of precautions are you advising that your members take for themselves and their employees to keep their, well, like I said, their workers safe as well as the truckers safe?
They're following all of the CDC requirements as well as all the requirements that the restaurant industry puts out. You know, they're cleaning everything a lot more than they would normally. They are, some of them are using masks or depending on the locality. They're, of course, offering hand sanitizer and hand sanitizer stations to customers and employees. They're obviously practicing social distancing. Everybody is very careful about making sure that we're keeping our customers safe and keeping the team members safe as well.
Lisa Mullings is president and CEO of the National Association of Truck Stop Owners. Lisa, thanks for being here. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your day.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Coming up after the break, the coronavirus stay-at-home orders have been tough on many of us in different ways, but for people recovering from addictions, the isolation presents a particular challenge. We'll be talking with a couple of experts on the subject. If you or someone you know is in recovery and want to share your story with us, or if you have a question for our experts, please give us a call, 800-222-9455. That number again, 800-222-9455. More 21st in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As the coronavirus pandemic continues, every week on the show, we've been having different conversations about the challenges that this situation can take on our mental health and offering different resources to help. Many of us have been counting the days since our life has been, quote, normal. People in recovery are used to counting days, but in a different way, marking time since they first got sober. And for millions of Americans who struggle with addiction, the stress and isolation caused by the pandemic can be especially challenging. As this situation continues to unfold, addiction experts locally and across the country are looking at different ways to meet people where they are and make sure they still have the support they need. Marissa Kirch is a social worker and the manager of addiction treatment services for Northwestern Medicine's Ben Gordon Center in DeKalb. She also oversees a women-only sober home. Also on the line with us, we have Dr. Thomas Wright. He's chief medical officer for the Rosecrans Health Network. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Just a note to our listeners, this conversation is one about addiction and sobriety. If you or someone you know is in recovery and have a question or want to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. That's 21st Show. And if you know someone needs help, or if you need help or more resources about addiction, you can also call 1-800-662-HELP. Again, that number is 1-800-662-4357. Dr. Wright, I want to begin with you. I understand your facilities are still open, but you've had to make some changes to your daily operations. What does that look like for Rosecrans?
Yeah, we're still open. We're a healthcare agency, so certainly an essential service at Rosecrans. And we know that addiction or mental health issues aren't going to take a vacation or a break during this. And so people still need help. You know, so we've done a lot in the last several weeks in order to sort of meet the need out there. Probably one of the biggest things that we've done is we've moved a lot of our, even our outpatient therapy or our groups to video conferencing based on WebEx and some other platforms in order to offer this. We've moved most of our psychiatrists to being able to do their services through telepsych services, so they're sitting distant from the patients. Patients can actually call in from their home if they have internet services to their psychiatrist, or they can still come to our office and we'll set them up to see someone there. We're doing groups through video conferencing too, so lots of treatment is still going on and available. And certainly if people come in, and a lot of our patients still need to do that, they need to have that touch point and that reassurance of coming in. You know, we have been sanitizing our facilities. We provide masks for them. In some of our residential facilities, we reduced the size of our groups in order to offer appropriate social distancing to them, and certainly are educating all our clients and staff on proper sanitation methods that we need to do. We're pushing, and we know even from studies that the most important thing people can do is to wash their hands and not touch their face. So in addition to giving them masks, so, you know, we're putting that actually in the schedule for them to be able to do that.
Hmm. So Marissa, I want to ask you sort of the same question. How have things changed your operations? Are things different day to day?
Oh, yeah. So we have also moved most of our services over to telehealth services. So we are still providing all of our group treatment, our individual one-on-one sessions, our psychiatry, case management, our job program services, pretty much everything via telehealth. So we got ourselves set up on different platforms like Skype, FaceTime, telephone to be able to meet those needs. And every treatment service line that we have is still running just via telehealth.
Okay. So over the past few weeks, we've been speaking, and I just kind of want to take a little step back here. We've been speaking with different mental health professionals about some of the challenges that have come along with this coronavirus crisis, social isolation, navigating relationships or loneliness, dealing with financial stress. And I wonder if you found that your clients, Marissa, are dealing with similar issues.
I think that one of the biggest struggles that we're seeing is that in general, we know people are meant for connection. Connection is a huge part of recovery. And so one of the things we work on in recovery is connecting to other people, connecting to a job, connecting to a purpose. And without that connection, people tend to connect into their addiction. And so what we're seeing right now is that that struggle with being able to connect with other people, being able to connect with the workplace, with purpose, et cetera. And so people are turning more towards the addiction.
And are you hearing specific stories of that? I mean, people, especially people I would imagine who are earlier in their path to sobriety, is that particularly daunting for them?
I think a lot of people are really struggling with that increase in the mental health, for one, anxiety, depression due to being more isolated, having more time getting stuck in their thoughts. They have more free time available. And one of the things we do for people in early recovery is structure their time. And so even with the virtual programming that we're providing, they don't have to get transportation to get there. So that takes less time. You know, they don't have to get up, get ready in the same way that they would if they were actually going in person. And so they do have a lot more time on their hands, which makes things more stressful. It makes things a lot more difficult for them to stay sober and to find things to occupy all of the time during the day, especially if they are also not working at this time.
Yeah. And, you know, I think if one of the things they do with that free time is get on social media, it seems like I've seen a lot of, and maybe this just depends on what your circle is, but, you know, people joking about day drinking, coping, you know, things like that. I mean, are there messages like that that are, you know, not helpful, to say the least?
For sure. I think that we're seeing that a lot. I also think that if you just look outside, I know just driving to the sober living home the other day, there were people out there drinking at 3 o'clock in the afternoon right outside the sober living home and the neighbors. Wow. So, you know, it's right there in their face on top of it. And I think that's a big struggle. I think the other thing we've seen on social media as well is, you know, we treat all different forms of addiction, and eating disorders are something that we also do some work with and is a co-occurring diagnosis for some of our clients. And there's a lot of posting also about eating during this time and gaining weight during this time. And that is another struggle people are having is, you know, I have all this downtime. And so, you know, I'm using drugs or alcohol or I'm eating. And these are the things that I'm supposed to be working on. And now there's even more messages about eating and using substances with all the free time that we have.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, we've been speaking with Melissa Kirch. She's a social worker and the manager of addiction treatment services for Northwestern Medicine's Ben Gordon Center in DeKalb. She also oversees a women's only sober home. Also on the line with us, we have Dr. Thomas Wright. He's chief medical officer for the Rosecrans Health Network. And a note to our listeners, if you or someone you know is in recovery or have a question and want to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Dr. Wright, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, from a medical perspective, about these challenges of addiction and staying clean, this idea of relapse triggers that are, I think, we've been sort of talking about here.
Well, you know, in addiction medicine or addiction treatment, we know that triggers happen all the time. And certainly this COVID crisis and some of the isolation, as Marissa said, you know, can be, or seeing people drink can be triggers. You know, in some ways, we don't try to avoid triggers too much because the idea is we need to teach them coping skills to manage these triggers. We certainly don't want to overwhelm them, which sometimes they're feeling right now, especially in early recovery. But triggers aren't necessarily a bad thing. You can learn a lot and practice a lot of your coping skills that we try to teach in order to manage that with this. So, I don't want to look at this as a silver lining, but there is some opportunity with this too at this time. But certainly we're seeing a lot of, as Marissa pointed out too, a lot more increase. What we know about addiction too is most of the time it doesn't happen in isolation. It happens in the context of depression or anxiety. Also about 80% of the cases do. So we're having to work a lot with our clients to help manage their anxiety to the depression that happens along with the isolation.
And, so Dr. Wright, I understand that, you know, obviously the path to sobriety is different for everyone, but I think a big part of recovery for a lot of people is going to meetings and being able to share and meet in person. I know you mentioned that some of these activities have gone virtual, but is a virtual 12-step meeting the same thing? Is that a good enough substitute for being able to meet in person?
I think that's a great opportunity now, and there is a fair amount of research about, you know, online 12-step group self-help, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous that are available, and anybody can find it too. You just have to Google online Alcoholics Anonymous or 12-step, and you don't even have to put the near me by it because you can join a group in San Diego or wherever, you know, in order to do that. And there's a lot of information about the effectiveness of that right now. Certainly, you know, we all need that face-to-face contact, but this is a great opportunity given what the availability is of other people through the internet now. So it's simple to do, and people that are longer in their recovery, where 12-step or group self-help is their primary source, certainly the online groups are a really good alternative.
That's interesting because I hadn't considered that. I guess if you wanted to get on with a group in San Diego, you don't have to worry about, you know, you can certainly get an even greater degree of anonymity than you could here in Illinois. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
But is there something lost without that, you know, the cups of coffee, the physical touch, the feeling of community?
Well, of course there has to be. I mean, there's something lost with that, with being next door. But, you know, there's also opportunity in it, too. Sometimes with given a little anonymity, people are more willing to share. So there's always a cost to that, but there might be a benefit to it, too. And some of the studies that are looking at that, you know, they look at the content, what people say and how other people respond to them, you know, in online versus face-to-face 12-step meetings are very, very similar, striking similarities to the communication patterns. So it certainly does look like it's a really viable alternative. People have to choose. Some people it doesn't work for at all, right? You know, it's just like sometimes a therapist doesn't work out for one person, and then you move on to the next or you do something differently. But, you know, I think it is certainly worth a try for everyone that needs that 12-step self-help support to do, and certainly is available right now. And growing, you know, by leaps and bounds. You know, this is one of the things that's happening as a result of this isolation is, you know, the availability of 12-step groups online is growing exponentially too.
Marissa, how have you in your organization been able to accommodate people who have these, you know, when you can't necessarily meet in person? How do you accommodate people and their needs, and what challenges has that posed?
Well, we have spent a lot of time working with our clients and getting them set up on the different telehealth options, getting their internet to work and getting their phones to work or their computers to work so that they are able to participate virtually. I think the biggest challenge with that is that we do have some clients who aren't very tech savvy, so having to do a little bit more hands-on with them, getting them set up. The other struggle is that there's a lot of distractions sometimes when you're participating in these activities from home. You know, potentially you have children going on in the background or your dog's barking or whatever it is that may be making it a little bit more difficult to stay focused and engaged on that platform. So I think that's kind of been a struggle for us there. Overall, though, I think, you know, the clients have been responding really well to it. We've gotten a lot of really positive feedback about it. On the plus side, it does eliminate some barriers that there were for people to attend treatment as far as transportation barriers or potentially some childcare barriers or just the way that timing lines up. They wouldn't have time to, you know, get somebody there to watch their kids and travel to group and make it on time. So, you know, there's some things that come out of it that are positive. And one of the things that people keep saying is, you know what, it's better than nothing. So at least this is still something that I can do to keep my life kind of structured, to get support, to be engaged in my recovery. And so I think that's been really great to hear is that it's better than, you know, having no services available at all.
Yeah. And we have a call now, Annette from Paw Paw, Illinois. I understand she's been sober for 18 years, and you have a suggestion. Annette, we don't have a lot of time, so just
That's
really
fine.
Briefly, like 10, 15 seconds, what is your suggestion for how to cope at this time?
Well, my name's Annette. On the 12th of this month, we'll be 18 years, clean, sober, no relapse.
Congratulations.
2 years. Gateway, Grace House in Chicago. I, you know, 2 years of inpatient practically, but I've never relapsed. And my suggestion is stay busy and focused. Reach out. Don't let your mind take you back to those places. And, you know, I'm stay busy. I have two dogs. Mm-hmm. I have three birds. I have a house now. I have a new car. You know, I'm retired now, but 18 years, no relapses. Stay busy. You know, there's hope. You can change your life. You know, you just got to keep looking forward. Don't look behind. You know, don't look in the past because that's only going to lead you to death, jail, or insanity. And I thank my higher power and for all the help that I received. And just hang in there and reach out to people.
All right, Annette, thank you so much for calling in. Thanks for calling, Annette. So Marissa, we heard there, stay busy, you know, look forward. What advice do you have for people who can't connect with a healthcare provider like you? Are there things they can do where they're at? And we've only got about a minute left here.
Yeah, I definitely recommend finding online support, structuring your time as much as you can, practicing your daily self-care, and connecting virtually as much as possible. There's lots of options out there.
And Dr. Wright, same question to you. I wonder, what are you doing to maintain your own mental health, doctor, as this, you know, situation is going on? Because you are not only dealing with your own self and family, but also all your patients, I would imagine, at this time, and taking on their concerns.
Well, sometimes doctors have trouble taking their own medicine, but I try to pay attention to what we're telling all our clients at Rosecrans, you know, and I think keeping a schedule is important. Make sure you eat regular meals, you know, when you're bored, don't eat, you know, eat regular meals, schedule your times, take breaks, get up at the usual time that you would get up. Exercise is available. Walking is a great exercise, and that's still available to us. Walk with social distancing and use the parks. These are all things that I'm trying to do, and we're recommending to patients too.
Dr. Thomas Wright is the chief medical officer for the Rosecrans Health Network. We also spoke with Marissa Kirch. She's a social worker and the manager of addiction treatment services for Northwestern Medicine's Ben Gordon Center in DeKalb. Both of you, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us about this important topic today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And just a note to our listeners, if you or someone you know needs help or more resources about addiction, please call 1-800-662-HELP. Again, that's 1-800-662-4357. Coming up, spring is a time for music students to share what they've been working on in recitals, but not during a global pandemic. So we'll be joined by a professor and four Illinois musicians ranging from third grade through grad school. They'll be with us for a conversation and a mini recital just ahead on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. For music students of all ages, end-of-year recitals and concerts are important milestones in one's development. And for some college students, they're not just milestones, but a requirement for earning a degree. But with Illinois' stay-at-home order extending through at least the end of April, there will not be any concerts anytime soon. To talk about this, we're joined by Kate Lewis, who teaches viola at Illinois State University. She's also invited several of her students to join us. Like a lot of music classes and everything else these days, we're speaking over Zoom. Kate, welcome to the 21st.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So I want to begin with what might seem like an obvious question, but why is public performance such an important part of music education?
Well, first of all, the two students I have with me today are performance majors, so they are interested in doing this as part of their career, going out and giving recitals in different types of venues, whether it be with orchestras or solo recitals or chamber music recitals. So it's a way of practicing that. It's also really a kind of a culmination of all of the semesters of applied instruction they've taken, all of the private lessons they've had, really since the time that they were small children through their college or graduate studies.
And as we mentioned, you're on the faculty at Illinois State, and I want to come back to your Illinois State students that you have with you. But in addition to teaching college students, you're involved in something called the ISU String Project. Can you tell us what is that?
Sure. This is a program where our music education majors and our music performance majors learn practical teaching skills with students from our community. So at ISU, we have a string project with 140 children in grades 3 through 8. And we have a staff of over 20 student teachers that work with them both in orchestra classes, small group classes, and private lessons.
And I gather there's usually a big concert or a recital at the end of the school year?
There is. It's a really, really fun celebration for all of us. Our concert was scheduled for May 3rd, and it was going to be just such a wonderful performance of music like Star Wars and a showcase of all of our beginners. And we even were planning to end the concert with all 140 students up on stage playing together.
Wow. So obviously with the stay-at-home ordering and any gatherings of more than 10 people not being allowed right now, that can't happen, unfortunately. And it seems like that there's a good chance that's going to extend beyond April 30th. So is there anything you can do to create music together when we're all being told to stay apart?
Well, the biggest challenge when we got these orders, and I, you know, realized very quickly that we wouldn't be able to have our big end of the year celebration, was how do we keep what we're trying to teach relevant, and how do we kind of keep it coordinated with so many teachers and so many students? And very early on, I started seeing in my own social media feed some wonderful examples from professional organizations all over the world of virtual orchestras. And I thought, goodness gracious, let's try to figure out how to do a virtual orchestra and string project so that we can still stay connected. So I've partnered with one of our students from Creative Technologies, and we are in the process of learning our parts so that we can create a virtual orchestra project of our own.
So I understand a couple of your string project students are with us, Gideon Rogers and Joaquin Herrante. Thank you both for being here. And Gideon, I'd like to ask you, what grade are you in?
I am in fourth grade.
Fourth grade, okay. And Joaquin, what about you?
I'm in seventh grade.
Seventh grade, okay. What instruments do you both play?
Violin.
Violin, okay. You know, I think our listeners would love to hear a little of what you've been working on so hard this year. Gideon, can you share some of your music with us?
Sure, I'm going to play Ode to Joy.
Okay. That was lovely. Thank you, Gideon. And Joaquin, I understand you're going to be playing the viola part of that. And I think listeners should know this would normally be accompanied by a violin, cello, and bass for the full instrumentation. Thank you, Joaquin. That was great. That was great. Kate, let's now talk about some of your students at ISU proper. For someone majoring in music performance, can you talk about the importance of the senior or graduate recital?
Yes, the final recital is really our capstone project. And so it's more than just about, you know, getting up there and playing music that they've been working on in some cases for over a year. But it's really a celebration of family and friends. They often invite, you know, family comes from all over the country. It usually involves dressing up and, you know, buying a new dress or a new outfit. There's often food involved afterwards, a reception. So it really becomes, you know, kind of one of the most important rite of passages in their lives. You know, almost in some cases more important than the graduation itself, because it's just theirs. It's their project. You know, they enjoy showing off the campus, which is beautiful this time of year, and our really beautiful town. So it's a kind of a big deal for them. And it's hard to, as an instructor, to help get that same enthusiasm about getting the recital repertoire together, knowing that we're not going to have that really celebration together in person.
And I guess it takes a lot of time to sort of get ready for this. So what do you, as an instructor, what do you advise your students to do? Do you, if you can't have the real public concert, does the show have to go on?
Well, the show has to go on because it is part of the requirements for the degree. So we do want them to graduate this spring, and that will be anticlimactic for seniors all over the state and the country. So they have a couple options. They can either do a live stream performance, which some of them do anyway during the actual live performance. Some of them have been using Facebook or other platforms to live stream the performances. And so they can, you know, set up a microphone in their living room and give a recital that we can all tune into, or they can opt to just send their studio teacher a recording of their recital music. So it's definitely not the same experience.
Well, I want to bring in two of your students. Rhoda Roberts and Chris Amann are with us. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
And Chris, let's begin with you. What is your instrument, and where are you in your studies?
I play the viola, and I am a grad student getting a degree in viola performance and string pedagogy. This is actually my last semester of graduate school.
Okay, well, congratulations on that. You were preparing for a recital?
Yes, my recital was originally scheduled for April 4th, actually.
Oh, goodness. But
with everything going the way it is, it'll have to be rescheduled for later on this month.
Okay, and so do you know, how are you planning to do it? Are you planning to have a virtual recital, Facebook Live or something like that?
I believe I will. It just depends. One of the problems that we've had with this whole stay-at-home order and you know, not being within, you know, 6 to 10 feet of each other, is the problem with having like a piano accompaniment. I won't be able to do that. So I'm not sure. I'm still trying to figure that out with how I'm going to do my recital.
Yeah, and I guess that's, people may not realize that, but if you are, you know, playing a solo instrument like that, it's not just you on the stage the whole time. There's usually a piano player accompanying for most of those pieces. Rhoda, I want to ask you, what is your instrument and where are you in your education?
I am a senior and I play violin.
Okay. And were you also preparing for a recital this semester?
Yes, I was. I'm not going to live stream mine, though. I'm going to actually record it, send it to my teacher. I'll be doing the recording on April 19th. Okay. And then I hope to do a recital after the stay-at-home order is over, maybe like the summer or even this fall.
Sure.
So I can actually still have the get-together with my friends and things.
Yeah, that makes sense, I guess. You sort of meet the requirements, you know, as you have to, but then you can still have the celebration later. Well, can I ask Rhoda, I don't know if you want to go first, if you can share a little bit of what you're working on for your recital?
Sure. I'm going to, you want me to play something?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. This is from Telemann's Fantasy Number 2. For solo violin, I'm going to play the second allegro.
Okay. That was great. And Chris, final request, same request of you. Can we hear a little bit of what you've been working on for your capstone graduate school recital?
Sure. I will be playing the Gigue from Johann Sebastian Bach's second suite in D minor.
Chris, that was great. You know, playing with or in front of an audience, I would imagine, Chris, is such an important part of music. And we've got just about a minute left in our conversation today. But can you talk about how does it change your relationship with the music to be presumably by yourself in front of a screen as opposed to with a room full of people?
I think what it comes down to is just that we as musicians, we work so hard for these pieces and these performances, and to really be able to show them in person is just very exciting, to be surrounded by people you love, your friends, your colleagues, your family, you know, all that type of stuff. To be able to just perform it in person, there's like a kind of a magic that happens during a performance where it just, it's like the culmination of all of the stress, all of the time that we put into these pieces to finally just be able to go out and say, I love music, this is what I'm doing, and I'm going to play for you. So doing it over like a recorded recital or a performance over a, you know, through a screen, it's just a little bit different because you don't have that in-person touch, I guess.
Chris Amon is a graduate student at Illinois State University. We were also joined by his fellow student, senior Rhoda Roberts, as well as string project musicians Gideon Rogers, who's in fourth grade, and Joaquin Herrante, who's in seventh grade. They were all joined as well by their instructor, Kate Lewis, who's an associate professor of viola at Illinois State University. Thank you all so much for being here and sharing your music with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for the 21st today. You can stay up to date with us on Twitter. Just follow us at 21st Show. That's 21st Show. We usually tweet out links and analysis and background on what we're talking about. We'd also love to hear from you by email. You can always email us talk@21stshow.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Our show is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpason is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.